Good evening, everyone. My name is Jerome Scott, and I'm a very grateful and very fortunate member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God, it's good to be here, and it's definitely good to be sober and somewhat dressed in my right mind. When I was thinking about the theme, A Design for Living, I reflected back when I was in seeking some mental health treatment. And the therapist was doing their case conference. And it's a weekly event. But I'm educated far beyond my capacity. And I would go up there and demand and knock on the door. What's my diagnosis? What's my prognosis? I need to know. Little white-haired psychiatrist would look out the room and say, Jerome, you just can't handle it. It's too deep. And I was fortunate enough to get sober and to return to school, and I was doing my internship, and this psychiatrist was the medical director of this facility. And I was in there doing one of my groups, and he came in and interrupted the group, and he said, this young man 10 years ago would come and demand his diagnosis and his prognosis. But now, after 10 years of sobriety, I believe he could handle it. And the good doctor's judgment, medical professional judgment, that I would be in some institution, some boarding care home, on medication for the rest of my adult life, and that I suffered from deep seeds of neurosis and episodes of schizophrenia, and that I would never function in society. And this design for living, this simple process outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, has not only afforded me the ability to have a life and a design, but to be able to function and be a productive member of society. And God knows, I knew I would never have the opportunity to come back, because I didn't have anything to come back to. Because I stand here tonight as a testament that I'm not a has-been. I'm a never was. And alcohol took me to a point in life that didn't even cross my mind. And that's why I'm grateful. Because I've been spared from an insidious disease called chronic acute alcoholism. See, something happens to me every time I drop, take anything that breaches the blood-brain barrier. Reaches the topmost part of my brain and kills the will to care. And while I'm under the influence, I can't care what happens to me, how it happens to me, and under what circumstances happens to me. See, I have a spiritual disease, a soul sickness that had dogged me every step of my life up until May of 1962. I was always restless, irritable, discontent, angry, separate, alone, and afraid. And I could not put any labels or names on why I felt so out of the ordinary, different from other siblings in my family. And I used to try to figure it out. Why am I so strange? And you know, I thought I had figured it out. I thought I had came up with a good understanding of why I was the way I had become. And see, I come from a large family. I have 9 other siblings, 3 older brothers, 2 younger brothers, and 4 sisters. And my parents were the working poor. My daddy didn't make enough money to get drunk, so he had to bring his paycheck home with all them kids. And his whole claim to fame was, there's a roof over our heads, there's food on the table, we were decently dressed, we could go to school, and there were values and principles that he expounded and insists that we acquire. But what made me an alcoholic was that on Saturday mornings was a ritual in our home. My mom would make breakfast for all us kids, and she loved to make buttermilk biscuits. And she'll roll out that door. I see some people in here know about buttermilk biscuits. She'll roll out that door, and she take that glass and bang, 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 and she make all these little old glass-sized biscuits. But what she would do with the remnants was she'd take it all in one big old huge biscuit. I never got that huge biscuit. Because those other three older brothers would beat me out of it every time. But really, in the summer of 1962, my father gave me five crisp $1 bills to go to my first high school dance to hear Hunter Hancock spin some records, him and old Marge at the high school. They called it a record hop. I had been looking forward to going to this dance for several years because that meant that I would have arrived. I would be able to associate and mingle with the elites in the neighborhood. And I would be the center of attention. I would be able to be alive at last instead of that laid-back radio or TV set, awkward, insecure, clumsy. For the first time, I would be a part of life. See, my old man didn't let me run around the streets and sing Blue Moon on the street lamps. He was a strict disciplinarian. He didn't take that mess. You better be at home in front of that TV when that street light came on. I didn't steal no tail lights off of 59 Cadillacs and hubcaps. But he gave me that fifth crisp $1 bills to go to that dance with my friends from Vacation Bible School, Cub Scout, Boy Scout. And we went to this dance, and someone in the crowd, I don't know, it wasn't me, said, "You know what? We can enhance this evening if we proposition this habitual guy who hung around the liquor store called Old Joe the Wino to get us something to drink." And I didn't want to seem like no chump, no poop butt, so I went along with the program. We beckon Old Joe in the alley, and we proposition him. We say, "Joe, we want to get something to drink for this dance tonight. Will you get us something to drink?" Old Joe said, "Well, what are you little young punks drinking?" And being, you know, worldly, as I say, sophisticated, I told Old Joe, "Well, whatever you drinking, Joe." Old Joe is a gallows man. He went and got some Gallo white port right off the top of the shelf. Hot. Wasn't even chilled. You know, it wasn't a grape in that wine. You know, it's all chemical. 21% by volume. And he said, "This is some powerful stuff for you little whippersnappers. It would be in your best interest to get some strawberry Kool-Aid to cut the taste." See, unbeknownst to me, I was going to be introduced to the original wine cooler. I'll never forget that first drink of wine. It was the most foulest beverage I had ever tasted in my young life. It almost made me gag. One part of me said, "Spit it up." But then that other part, that loud part, said, "If you spit it up, chump, it'll be a reflection on your manhood. Force it down." And I forced it down into my chest cavity, and I got that warm sensation. And then it hit the pit of my stomach. I got this instantaneous rush that radically transformed my entire life. I knew three things instantly: that I could act, I could perform, and it didn't matter what anybody thought about it. All of a sudden, my Marlboros came out of my sock and into my top pocket, and I became Marlboro Man. No longer was I shy, insecure, awkward, and clumsy. I could lean with whatever I had to say and do. No longer did I have a stick up my behind. I was cool. Instant cool. Got up to that dance with belligerent, intoxicated, created a disturbance and a commotion, cigarette dripping all off my lip, talking out the side of my neck, talking more noise than a radio. And the lady said, you can't come to this dance. And I had to correct her immediately. I told her, I've been waiting to go to this dance for 3 years. I have my $3, and I'm not going to be denied. You need to get your superior here immediately so we can discuss this thing. She had her superior there. He was a sergeant for the Los Angeles Police Department. And she had sent for him as soon as I started talking. Thank God my friends who had took me to that dance said, we better leave here and leave here in a hurry. We left out the back way, which was going to come an MO later on, the back way every way. And someone said, that's all right about that funky dance. We could go there anytime. Let's get some more wine. And see, that's what separates me from a social drinker, problem drinker, into chronic acute alcoholism. I came on and I came on in living color. And I said, no, it's not going to be that way. You get yours and I'll get mine. And I drank for the effect. And that's what makes me an alcoholic. Despite the consequences, despite the circumstances, I will continue on trying to produce that glow and that effect that alcohol gave me. And later on that night, my good friends from Vacation Bible School propped me up on my old man's front door. Rung the doorbell. They didn't stick around to discuss anything with Mr. Scott. And I have this older brother who I hated with a passion, who had ridiculed and belittled me all of my life. Took that biscuit every chance I had. I fell in, he said, well, look at the little punk, he's drunk. And that wine told me, tonight, we're going to settle this score immediately. But my coordination was a little off, and my left jab fell over, and I missed him, and I crashed and broke my mom's coffee table. You know, the one with the mermaid up under it. She rushed to the living room immediately after this crash, and she knew when she took her eyes on me, she knew it was going to be violence and mayhem. And it was going to be inflicted upon her young son, because when the real man who wore the pants in our family caught the young fake man who was intoxicated, it was going to be swift retribution. And they tried to get me out, but the wine wouldn't allow me to be hid or disposed of. And my dad came from the back of the house, and he took one look, and he knew something gravely was wrong with one of his sons. And he looked at the damage on the floor, and he leaped across that room in a single bounce, snatched all 90 pounds of me up. And he wasn't like Bill Cosby, Art Linkletter, Father Knows Best, go to your room, we'll discuss it tomorrow, you intoxicated. He was a strict disciplinarian. They didn't have 911 then. Oh, man, he knocked me back in that chair, and he was wailing on that head. He got tired, he picked up a belt, and he was wailing on it. And I'm sitting there taking all this abuse and this punishment and needing a teardrop. And I'm sitting there reflecting on my experience with that initial drink. And all I could think of, I could act, I could perform, and it doesn't matter what anybody think about it. This stuff is miraculous. I don't feel no pain. My faith was sealed. I got married that day in the latter part of May of 1962 to a little girl in my neighborhood, commonly known as Sweet Lucy. I said, for rich or for poor, better or for worse, through good times and bad, to death do us part. Serious commitment. Because I wasn't going to give up that wine no matter what happened. What the circumstances or the conditions, because it held out the promise that I would be a part of and I won't have to suffer the consequences of any of my actions. And every chance I got drunk. And every chance my old man caught me, he punched me out. I graduated from high school in 65, and I was sitting at the kitchen table that early part of July, right after graduation. And my old man came in there, and he was a little upset with me. He stood over me screaming and foaming at the mouth, talking about he had paid the mortgage And I had not contributed not one dime to that endeavor. He said his family would have something to eat because he is responsible. He goes to work and he provides. And he says the utilities are paid. And you haven't contributed not a dime to it. And he says it's only one. He stepped around. He says, only one man wear the pants in this family, and it's me. And since you can't go along with my program, there's the dough. Let it hit you where the good Lord split you, and don't let it hit you on the way out. Arrogant, self-centered, egotistical. I went into the cupboard, got a Safeway paper sack, got my only suit from Zyler's and Zyler, blue on blue pinstripe. And I told him what to do with his house, food, and lights. And I stepped off to my chosen profession of being a hustler. Oh, I see. There are no hustlers in the room. Well, let me break hustling down for you. Well, mine was a pitiful type of hustling. I'm not going to be grandiose. I stole the newspapers in front of the Greyhound bus station down on Skid Row. And I sold them on Spring Street like I had a route. And when that didn't work, I sold whole blood every 58 days and plasma twice a week. Now, it's an art to selling plasma. You have to do it a long time. Like they take a little drop of iodine, a little drop from your earlobe or fingertip, and drop it in a big vial of iodine to see if your blood is marketable. And that's where I learned to pray. They dropped that drop down there, and I closed my eyes. I said, I hope it stay down. Who wants to be embarrassed in front of a whole bunch of other tramps at 5 o'clock in the morning, rejected and throw out the place? How would I account for that? But see, I would have a plan. See, I'm selling my life bodily fluid. And this is just seed money to come up quick. I'm just going to sell this so I can get me something decent to eat, maybe get me some decent clean clothes, go work at the day labor market, get me a little nest egg rolling, check into junior college, get me a trade, get me a five-figure job, you know, don't have to be high five-figure, just like a five-figure job would do, and buy me a pre-owned automobile, get wino sharp like I am tonight. Pull up in front of my old man's house at 4 o'clock. I know at 4 o'clock sharp, Mr. Property Owner, citizen, never been arrested, is sitting in front of his lawn, warding his grass. And I'm going to pull up in front of my pre-owned automobile, get out of my vehicle and lean on it. And tell him, say, see, sucker, I told you I was going to be somebody. And get off and roar off. See, that's 4 hours on the couch while they take your red blood cells and separate your white blood cells and put the red blood cells back in. I'm planning. But as soon as I get off that couch, get my graham cracker and broth, I remember something I read in the last emergency room I was in. Since you done depleted your red blood cell count, a little red wine would build it back up. Oh, I'm telling you, those streets will chew you up and spit you out. I'm talking about in the early 70s, homelessness wasn't fashionable. They didn't have a safety net. And I'm talking about I would be in a coat too long to be short and too short to be long, looking like death sucking a soda cracker. I'm talking about don't have the shakes, the leaps, and I show up in the neighborhood because I know they're responsible for my condition. And I'm going to make them real sorry for throwing me out in the streets. And I get me a strategic location where I know I'm going to run into one of my mom's friends from Bible study. I know I'm going to run into some of them sisters from Metropolitan Baptist Church. And I get me a location. I see one of them going in the market. And I say, Miss So-and-so, I need something to eat. Could you feed me? Do a good Christian deed. And she'll grab her purse and run in the market. Total rejection. But see, I didn't have the customer service skills that some of us homeless people have today. Today they would say, God bless you, brother. God loves you. Have a good day. Oh, when that lady come out of there, Oh, God. She had a tirade foaming at the mouth, raving maniac, cussing her all the way to the car. And I know she would call my mom or call my dad or some member from the church. Mr. Scott's son was down there on the streets. Oh, he looked so bad, and he was performing so bad. And that would just, I'm Junior, and that would tear my old man's heart up. Just tear it up. And he'd say, come on back home. And I come back. And he said, no drinking in here. I said, Dad, I'm going to straighten up, fly right, turn over new leaf, take care of business. I'm going to get me a job. I'm going to school. I'm going to make you proud. I came off the streets one time. I was serious in a heart attack. Checked into junior college. Going to be an x-ray technician. Doing great. Got me a part-time job for the county. Went down there, didn't know anything about libraries assistant. Took the test and bam, hired the same day. Checked into college, doing great. Christmas came up, I decided to go to this party. I needed some recreation with some of my classmates. These are not these derelicts I hung around with. This is a college person. Went up there to go to this party, and this guy had stolen a burglar alarm truck. I say, wait a minute, man, I'm going to meet some girls in a stolen burglar alarm truck? Are you crazy? I turned around and I was going to walk back home. And the back of that van swung open. It was Rabbit, Mad Dog, and Pookie. They had a half a gallon of XLO white port and the biggest joint I had ever seen. And the smoke hit me in the face. And they say, oh, you think you better than us. And of course I was, so I decided to educate them that night about how they could raise their standard of living. But they didn't too much care for my psychological and educational counseling, and they start stomping my head on the street. And the police rolled up, and in a drunken daze, I stumbled and jumped on the police car. Now I tell you, the police car has an entirely different sound going in a high pursuit when you're on top of it, as opposed to you being in it. Oh, man, that police car took off, wheels smoking, shot up the street around the corner in a dark alley, and those police gave me a serious spiritual awakening. I'm talking about I almost lost my left eye. And they arrested me for felonious assault against a police officer, and I was chained to the bed in the hospital ward up at General Hospital, not knowing if this eye would ever be functional. And I'm sitting there with the patch, and everything is shut, and I can't see. But I'm going over the event of how I blew it. Because I blew school, doing great. Because, see, I'm not a dumb person, just a little inconsistent. Inconsistent by wine. I blew the job. And I'm trying to figure out what happened. Every time it got down to that wine, I would say, no, it wasn't the wine. It was those people you were with. If you were drinking with some better people, you wouldn't be in this predicament. And from then on, I became explainer. Because all of my friends in the neighborhood saw me go by on top of the police car. And my only thought is, I could never be cool again. That's when my mom and them took me and got me some therapy. You know, my mom took me over there to see the psychiatrist. I'll never forget it. I went over there that Monday. They did their little old assessment and evaluation, and the next day I was going to start treatment. And that first day in treatment, I'm sitting in there waiting in the lobby to go back to the group session. I met this other guy from the neighborhood that I didn't know, and he flashed on me. He flashed second all, true and all, or anything at all. My therapy went out the window because I drop anything too thin to chew. And I went through those barbiturates like they were, it wasn't even an addiction. But when you OD, or let me put it this way, OD and in a coma, and you say that you were sleeping for 72 hours. Yeah. Nobody sleeps 72 hours. You're in a coma. Because, see, I like to chase barbiturates with second all F40s with Bourbon Deluxe. See, that don't mean 1 + 1 = 2. It has a synergistic effect. 1 + 1 = 6 and 8. And I'd be walking along, you know, trying to be cool off of these second alls and drinking this here Bourbon Deluxe and Old English, and all of a sudden they would start affecting my equilibrium. And you know, and your equilibrium gets radical, and you start falling like you're a tree. And I'd hit the pavement, and I'd bounce back up, and I'd say, didn't nobody see that? The Los Angeles police have arrested me more times than I could count. They would drive up downtown and say, get in, Jerome. 647F. I don't know how many times I've been in Unit 3. That's the county hospital psycho ward. 72-hour lockdown, hold Thursday and shuffle in the middle rail twist. I show up there because now alcohol is not working. And sometimes I'm so sick going into DTs and hallucinations, audio and visual. And I show up at the hospital for my three hots and a cot, three hot meals and a place to lay my head. And I'm terrorizing the family, and I'm blaming them for everything. They had this little old room. They called it Sonny's room. And in Sonny's room is this here filthy urine-soaked mattress. And I'm drinking in the back of the house with that cheap wine every day. And it has this stench of that filth and that urine in my parents' house. And I would go into DTs and I'd be hallucination, hyperventilating, screaming at the top of my lungs in the middle of the night. And only two people come near me, be my dad and my mom. And my dad would get down on that mattress and hold me like I was just a little infant and be rocking me. And I'd cuss him out. Get your hands off of me. And I thought it was all their fault. And I get downtown on the streets, and I'm a belligerent drunk. Because, see, I only drink to four states. Either I pass out, black out, fall out of my mouth, would encourage someone to knock me out. Because I got a death wish. Nothing but a death wish. Too chicken to commit suicide, so I'll try to get one of you citizens to do it. Oh, I used to mess with the police. I never forget I was messing with this rookie cop. Everything by the book. I'm just harassing him, just cussing all his lineages and everything. And I guess we got to the holding cell, to the booking, and I got on that last nerve. Because, see, I would alternate between drunk and citizen. So when I'm a citizen, I want to know your badge number. And he got tired. He said, you want my badge number? He took his badge off and put it in the palm of his hand and said, bam! And I had his number right on my forehead. 1972, I'm at my wit's end. I'm at my literal wit's end. I'm 6'2", and I'm weighing something like 115, 25 pounds. And I'm talking about I'm slack. My people don't want me around no more. I've been downtown for weeks. And my younger brother was getting married to his childhood sweetheart. And he had decided that he was going to drop out of Cal State San Luis Obispo and come home and get married. And he told my dad that since he was getting married in the family church and I was his oldest brother, was only fitting and right that I would be his best man. And they came down to Skid Row and got me. Dressed me up in a tux. Oh, man. I'll never forget that bath, though. They gave me a bath with some Vogue washing powder, which will clean anything. And added a couple of drops of Purex to make sure it would work. Because I was, oh, you talking about filthy? Oh, man. And I stood up at that wedding as this best man. My mom wanted me to meet her supervisor's husband, who was a sober member of AA. And at the reception, standing at my new sister-in-law's parents' house, and I'm standing at the fence, and this guy was telling me his story. He had said that He had twin daughters, and his wife had gave him $3 to go get the baby some milk. And he took that $3 and he didn't come back for 2 days. He was drunk. And that was so horrified him that it made him go to AA and get sober. And I listened thoughtfully to this man. And I reasoned. And I reasoned and I thought. I said, well, when I get twin daughters and a wife, and I run off with their milk money, then I'll go to AA. But shortly thereafter, I ended up in Camarillo State Hospital. If anyone in the room has done institutional work at Camarillo, my hat is off to you. I'm thankful and I'm grateful. Because there weren't a night in that hospital where they didn't have a meeting. But I was there under duress. Boy meets girl on the Nut House campus and falls in love. This lady, who was on the ward, a patient as I, had been to the best prep schools in Europe, spoke four foreign languages fluently. But baby was in the Nut House with me. And she would say, Jerry, Jerry, they're going to have an AA meeting at 8 o'clock. They're going to have cookies, donuts, coffee, and cigarettes. Let's go. And I'll call her a pregnant dog and tell her to get out of my face, slut. But out of lust and loneliness, I went to an AA meeting. So it's not what you come for, it's what you stay for. I got out of that hospital after 90 days, ego tripping. Abraham Maslow, Fritz Perls are my heroes. All the intellectual giants in psychology, they was going to get me together. And I had done such a wonderful job in getting sober, I thought it would be a good thing to do is to undo that and do it again. And I got drunk. And the very night I got drunk, she called me. She was out of the hospital and she says, I'm going to a meeting. Do you want to go? And she said, I said, yeah. What, no girls calling my parents' house, taking me out nowhere? As a matter of fact, my brother, who got married, really embarrassed me. He went down to the courthouse and got his marriage certificate. And at that time, they had a TV program, the newlywed game and the dating game. And he gave them my name as a good person to call to come and be a contestant on the dating game. They call. I'm right off of Skid Row with no teeth in my head, you know. Even I knew I wasn't a candidate material for the dating game. Don't embarrass me like that. But this young girl called me. She was in a recovery home on Carondelet. And she came and picked me up and took me to this meeting where I met my sponsor. I didn't hear anything in that meeting other than the Lord's Prayer. That's what I heard at that meeting. Huge meeting, just like this. About 300 or 400 people got up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. In that drunken stupor, I flashed back to 2 years previously. I had been stabbed in the back. The knife had pierced my heart and broke off in my lungs, and I was dying. Wasn't no doubt I was dying. And I tried to remember some prayer growing up in a religious home with some religious training and background. I could not even remember. Now lay me down to sleep. I was so hateful that I was so far removed from any type of spiritual teachings, or I couldn't even say, God, will you please help me? But hearing that Lord's Prayer got me to come back to that meeting. And I would come back to that meeting on an infrequent basis if the Lakers or Star Trek wasn't on. But that's where I met my sponsor. Little old guy, about 2 years sober. Ethnically, financially, we worlds apart. I wouldn't have never met this man if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. PhD in literature from Indiana. He stuck out his hand at the door. He says, hi, my name is Jack. And he says, Jack K is my name and sobriety is my game. Call anytime. And he held my hand 5 seconds longer than any man should hold my hand. And for the next 10 months, he gave me his card. It says, Jack K is my name and sobriety is my game. I said, damn, he's a poet too. For the next 10 months, If I'm at that meeting, that's Jack's home group, the Wilshire Normandy group. He'll burst across the room, stop what he's doing, talking to his friends, his other AA babies, his wife, his sponsor. He'll rush across that room and he say, "Jerome, how you doing?" And I had that newcomer line, "I'm fine." Lying. I'm talking about I look new, I smelled new. Everything about me was saying, "Somebody, will you please intervene and help me?" And I collect those cards. One time, downtown on Skid Row, coming out of DT's, I had Jack's card in my top pocket. And I came somewhat coherent. I looked at his card. I said, "I'm going to call this chump Jack and see what he could do." This AA. I called his house. The phone rang 3 times. Jack didn't make a mad dash, push his wife off his lap and tell the dog, "Move out the way. That's Jerome calling. Can I help?" I say, "Jack don't care. AA sucks and stay drunk." That's why I'm known around some circles as a Camarillo Nuthouse rethread. And I was there for another 90 days. And that last May of 1973, I'll never forget it as long as I live. Because it's real dark just before the light of sobriety comes in your life. I'm sitting in the county, in the nut house, facing a year in the county jail. Ain't no doubt. Because I know as soon as my probation officer find out I've been arrested for playing drunk, I'm going to jail for a year. Because he already been violating me every 30 days. Like I was on an installment plan, sending me to Wayside Honor Rancho to be a pig farmer. Didn't know anything about pigs. I'm from South Central. What I know about farming, you know? That May, I'm sitting in the day room up at Camarillo. A gentleman comes in all dressed sharp with a white shirt and a tie. And he's walking on the ward. He says, "I'm looking for Jerome Scott." So the attendant points him out to me over here sitting in one of those chairs. And he come over there, he said, "Are you Jerome Scott?" I say, "Yes." He says, "I'm Special Agent so-and-so from the Internal Revenue Service. You owe us $8,000. And I look at him, I say, "You ain't nothing but a damn fool." I say, do I look like I have $8,000? Do you know where I'm at? This is Camarillo Nut House. He just turned around and left. And I screamed at him. I said, "You can't get blood from a turnip either." Because, see, I had worked my only job besides that part-time job at the county. My psychiatrist had got me a job at International Business Machine as an operations clerk. And as an operations clerk, I had worked almost a whole year, and I had bought one share in IBM stock and employee purchasing plan. And so that year, I wanted to get all my income tax back, so I lied and told them I had 12 kids. I got all my money back, but I couldn't verify the children, you know. So they wanted their $8,000 back. And the next week, Mr. Linker came up there on Mother's Day, my probation officer. Not parole, probation. I'm on probation for a $5 bag of marijuana that was not mine. It wasn't. It was my best friend's. He was standing in front of me, and the police were behind me. I didn't see the police. And he asked me to do him a favor. He said, "Will you hold my marijuana for me?" And I did. So I was on probation for 6 years for a nickel bag of weed. So Mr. Linker came up there on Mother's Day with his 90-year-old mother to visit me. And he talked real nice to me. But when he got down to his car, he got real nasty and sarcastic. He said, "Mr. Scott, if you get arrested in the vicinity of a liquor store for jaywalking or spitting on the sidewalk, I guarantee you're going to do a year." I already had a year coming, so. And his little white-haired mother stuck her head out the window and said, "Good luck, young man." I wanted to cuss her out, too, but I bet not. I was depressed. Depressed. And see, what happened was 2 weeks later, just before Memorial Day, it was another young man from South Central had one of Jack's cards. Jack had another baby in Camarillo, had ran up to Camarillo to get away from AA. And this young man was named Raymond. Raymond called him. You know it had to be a collect call to your sponsor. Because what AA baby goes to the nut house with enough change to call a sponsor? None. Call Jack. Say, Jack, this is Raymond. I'm in the nut house and I'm not crazy. Will you come and get me and take me to that A&A recovery house you was talking about? Jack got in his plush AA Beamer that AA had given him from West Hollywood and drove all the way up to Ventura County to pick this guy up, some 55 miles. And they were leaving, off to war. And I'm sitting kicked back like I'm in my living room reading the Los Angeles Times business section if I had some stocks or bonds. I was checking on that one share I had bought to see if it had split. And my sponsor eased behind the paper. And he said, Jerome, what are you doing here? I knew that voice. I said, damn, he done followed me to the nut house. But he asked me a question in the latter part of May of 1973. He says, Jerome, what are you doing here in Camarillo State Hospital? And unbeknownst to me, I got rigorous honors, not only with him, but with myself. And the answer that I could give him that day was simply, I don't know. I don't know why I'm here. I have no inkling to my condition or my circumstances. I guess I'm here for just a little R&R, rest and relaxation. And he saw my perplexion and my confusion. He didn't immediately come from some superior, knowledgeable premise and say, Jerome, you need to do this or talk down to me or belittle me. He looked at me with all the compassion and love that one alcoholic could have for another. And I knew in an instant that here was someone standing before me that cared about me and was willing to do anything to help me. Because an alcoholic will know in an instant when someone is being judgmental. He'll turn them off in an instant. Because I can look in his eyes, and I've seen that look before. I've seen that look in my mom's eyes. I've seen that look in my father's eyes. I've seen that look on strangers on the street who came and rescued me from my own madness. And I know he loved me. And he said, Jerome, I'll never forget it as long as I live. He said, Jerome, if you do what I do and follow what I follow, you will never have to drink as long as you live. You will not have to drink if life and some of the vestiges that life could inflict upon you, some of the heartaches and frustrations and disappointments, you won't even have to drink even then. And you won't ever have to come to a place like this unless you choose to. See, that's what AA promised. The ability to face life on life's terms, not ducking or dodging any of life's issues. And there are plenty of issues to deal with life. Because I think people are hardy. And I had a lot of issues to deal with. Lots of issues to deal with. Far too many to overcome by myself. And he stuck out his hand to assist me and to help me to overcome those issues. And I have something that will keep me sick even today. And it's my baseless pride. It will dictate how I'll and when I receive the help I so desperately need. And that day I couldn't go with Jack and Raymond because my pride wouldn't let me get up out of that seat. That baseless pride wouldn't let me move. And it's more formidable than any resentment I'll ever have. And it's always lurking in the shadows upon me and undermine whatever spiritual growth I may ever acquire. Jack and Raymond turned around and walked away, and I did what I always do, pour me a drink. And I got out of that hospital a week later. Well, basically, the reason why I say I didn't leave is that I had $67 in patient account and it was Sunday. And I wasn't going to leave my $67 in no nut house for nobody. But I didn't realize that $67 was going to finance my last drunk, because I got that check from Camarillo, was at the First Bank of Camarillo with no ID, cashed the check, went to buy my bus ticket to come back to L.A., and the bus was going to be 30 minutes late. And I said, well, since it's going to be 30 minutes late, I need a little refreshment. I went and got me a bottle of wine. I was so drunk, and I was just terrorizing the bus driver. As a matter of fact, he was coming down Pacific Coast Highway, and he was going to let me out in Malibu. Not in the town of Malibu. You know that part of Pacific Coast Highway where it's nothing. But I begged him to be kind with me. He let me stay on the bus. And I got back, and I reached my parents' house, and I was in a drunken blackout stupor, and I assaulted my dad, the only friend I had. I hit him, kicked him, and knocked him to the floor. By now, he's not a robust man. He has heart disease and emphysema, and he's sick. The only person who would come up to the county jail and bring me $3 so I wouldn't have to pick up butts off the floor. The only person who would treek up to Camarillo on the bus to see his son. I got there, kicked him, and knocked him down and spat on him. They had me arrested. And I did one day in the county jail, and I still had some of that money from him. Got a kick out. And got drunk again. Saw my aunt crossing the street from my father's house. I said, get that B too. And I chased my loving aunt to her house. And she ran in. I thought she was running from me. But she wasn't running from nephew. She was running to get that pearl handled snub nose 38. I forgot she had it. But when she came to the door with it, I said, oh, shit. Because, see, I know something. People on the streets will say, oh, don't kill him, he's drunk. But you mess with family, they'll take you out. I ran and jumped in a trash can and hid for a very, very long time. And I got out of that trash can. The police was there. They took me to jail again. And on that city jail, on the 5th of June, 1973, I had a spiritual awakening. I thought about all the people I had met in those previous 10 months who had extended themselves with sincerity and love to try to help me. And I couldn't figure out why I could be in some institution and I could do fine. But as soon as my foot struck Zion, I'd have a problem. And I made a commitment that day. I didn't promise God, I didn't promise anybody. I promised myself that if I could get off this floor, I'm going to try to make it back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a kick out of jail again. And that was the 6th of June. I had one day of sobriety. I was filthy and nasty because I had passed out by the commode and nobody asked me to move. And so I needed a change of clothes to go to my first AA meeting. I couldn't go that way. And I broke into my mom's house. And I was in there getting into my brother's clothes. He was away. And I was getting all sharp. And she approached the room. She said, what are you doing here? I said, what it look like? I'm getting dressed. And she got to, I got to talking that drag to her. And she said, son, you might not be familiar with B.B. King's new record. And my mom told me, she said, don't nobody love you but your mama? And she might be jiving too. And she said, we old and we tired. Why don't you leave? Because your dad said, if you ever light his doorstep, he's going to kill you. And I don't want any violence in my house. Why don't you leave? And I left her house, and I walked down to this AA clubhouse in South Central L.A., 9604 South Figueroa. A broken young man, 26 years old. Not a has-been, but a never was. No hope. And I walked into that meeting. This time I sat up front and I began to listen like only the dying could hear. But that pride is slow to die. I left out of that meeting. A guy with a year's sobriety offered me a ride. I didn't have enough gumption, enough honesty to tell that man I didn't have a place to stay. I just said, well, drop me off here on this corner. And I was going to wander the streets that night. I was going to wander back down to Skid Row. And I got almost to Skid Row. And for the first time in my little miserable life, I listened to that still, quiet voice. And that still, quiet voice that I heard talk to me said, if you go down the Skid Row, Jerome, you're not coming back. You're going to die. And I turned around at 3 o'clock in the morning with no place to go, and I ended up at my father's front door. And I knocked on his door, and he came to the door, and he said, what do you want? I told him, I said, Dad, I think I could stop drinking it if you could offer me a place to stay and some help. And we made a bond that night. If I didn't drink, I could stay. I have not had a drink, drop, or snort or anything that breaches the blood-brain barrier since June 6, 1973. And I came here with more issues than the law would allow. But see, I arrived in AA where it was no nonsense, practical AA people. And they didn't believe in you had an opinion of anything. They say, you don't know nothing about staying sober. Shut up and sit down. And I'm talking about these people seem like if you didn't, they would do something to you. So I did what they said. If they said jump, I asked how. And I never forget, I got my first 90 days at the beginner's meeting. I was able to share at the meeting. I would say, one day, my ship is going to come in, and everything is going to be all right. Keep coming back, newcomers. The program works. And I'll run back there with someone 2 days more than me or less and say, how did I sound? And I got at this Saturday noon meeting, and they undressed me real spiritually one Saturday. And this lady named Marion C., God bless her, wherever she is, she said, Jerome, you've been talking about that shit when your ship is going to come in. She said, when in the hell are you going to send a ship out? And they laughed just like you did. Seemed like they laughed for a whole day, but I'm so thankful that I was able to hear what she said after that, because that's what saved me. She said, Jerome, sometimes life will have some storms that are so severe and so devastating that if your ship is tied to the moorings, it will smash against the rocks and can't nothing come back. She says, sometimes you have to put your ship out on God's seas and pray that they come back, because faith without works is dead. And this faith has to work in you and through you on a daily basis. So what she was telling me was I needed to go about acquiring some faith. And I was without a clue, because I'm an agnostic and a belligerent unbeliever. Me and God is still not on speaking terms. But I watch and learn by example. This one guy, I'm sitting in the club, and I'm retired on SSI and ATD, and they don't allow you to be, a welfare leech at my club, you know. And these guys came in there and said, you're going to look for a job today, Jerome. They came and got me and took me out of the club. Took me to this place where I could fill out an application for a custodian's job, and the line stretched from here, looked like the State Street. And they came back and checked on me, too. I didn't get that job, but I'm sitting in there complaining about I don't have a work record. I've never worked before, but 11 months. And this guy gave me a ride, he pulled over to the side of the street in South Central on Figueroa about 11 o'clock at night. He said, we're going to treat this spiritually. This is how we deal with this. We'll treat it spiritually right now. And he pulled over to the curb, 11 o'clock at night after the meeting. He said, give me your hands. I gave him my hands, and he said, we're going to pray on your job. He started praying, and I started opening one eye, looking around to see if who was driving by seeing these two men hold hands in the car. So I come back to the club the next day, and the meeting, noon meeting is over, and I'm sitting there. This guy come Never saw him before. Burst in the club. He said, is any alcoholic in here want a job? I said, God dang, this spiritual stuff is too quick. And see, I needed transportation. This guy wanted me to open up a gas station for him. And I needed transportation, so I had to, needed a co-signer for my first car, sober car. And this friend of mine said, I'll co-sign for you, Jerome. I said, no, I'll go ask my dad. And my dad wouldn't co-sign for me for a pair of roller skates. But he saw that I was sober, and he did. And I took my dad, the only place I could take him to was to that AA clubhouse at noon, you know. And my dad lived to see me sober 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And by that time, this lady had told me that it would be a good idea if I apply for the post office. I told them they ain't going to hire me. She said, you haven't took the test. You haven't passed it. They haven't offered you no physical or anything. I took that test 39 times. After taking it 9 times, I memorized all 9 tests. And I got a perfect score. Because on a federal application, they want to know dates, places, and disposition back to April 15, 1939. Have you ever been arrested? And I told my sponsor, Jack is still my sponsor. I said, Jack, I don't remember all those times. He said, oh, that's all right, Jerome. I know of a guy with the same predicament as you. He had a long arrest record, and he went down to Parker Center, paid the $17, and they sent off to J. Edgar Hoover Building for his records. I'm quite sure they knew about you, too. So I had a big old thick application. All these arrests, plain drunk, felonious assault against a police officer. And then they wanted to know, have you ever been treated for alcohol or drug addiction? Camarillo, long, oh, man, like a little application in itself. I'll never forget, I went to this one interview in El Monte, and the postmaster in El Monte called my name. And I got up to go for my interview, and I got to the door. He said, damn, I didn't even believe you would show up. Oh, what a way to go into an interview. He walked me in the front door, out the back door. He said, this is your interview. And he got to the door, and he slammed it. And before he slammed it, he said, if you work in my post office, it'd be over my dead body. And I almost went postal before I went to work for the post office. But I went and called my sponsor, Jack. I always call Jack. I called Jack on the phone, told him how they were treating me and that what I was going to do. And I'm never going down to the post office for another job. So he asked me, he said, how many times you took the test, Jerome? I said, I took this test 39 times. He said, well, how many times have you been for an interview? I said, this is the fourth and last time. I'm never going there. He said, look at it this way, Jerome. It might be necessary for your recovery and your sobriety to go down there 35 more times as an exercise in character building. I said, damn, Jack, how much character do you want me to have? But I only went down there about another 4 more interviews. And this guy, who wasn't an alcoholic, was just a fair-minded person. He read my whole application. And at the bottom of that application, it stated that for the past 5 years, it hasn't been necessary for me to do or repeat any of the above. And he believed me. He says, I believe in your rehabilitation, and I'm going to treat you just like any other job applicant. And he hired me to carry the United States mail, and I carried the mail for 3 years. And I'll never forget that first day they offered me to carry mail. They gave me about 9 feet of SSI checks. I'm only 5 years sober. That don't mean, you know, I'm thoroughly honest. And I thought about it. I said, you know, you could come up quick with a couple of these checks. But see, your experience comes in handy. And I remember my experience messing with people's checks. You know, that used to be one of my hustling operations. I wait till the mailman drops somebody's check in, and then I go help myself. And I did that one time. I reached in the mailbox. I said, oh, this is easy picking. And I grabbed that lady's SSI check, and that screen door exploded. boom, it just flew off the hinges. And it was the largest black woman I ever saw in my life. She had to be 350 pounds. There I am, all 145, 115 pounds. I smile. Oh, she's not going to catch me. But see, when you drug out by wine, you lose a couple of steps. And I was hauling. I thought I was making some distance. And I looked back, she was gaining. I said, oh, take that check. That told me, say, leave the government checks alone. You'll be running all your life. Now, I've been with them for 21 years. And next Friday, I'm going in and turning my resignation. Because I've grown as much as I can at the U.S. Postal Service. I've gotten to a point, it's either grow or go. I choose to grow and go. Because 8 years ago, they told me, they said, in order to hold your job and maintain your job, you have to get a master's degree. Not one of those fly-by-night mail order masters. They wanted it documented. Master's degree. And here I was. I graduated from Jefferson High School, and they only had one microscope, and it was broke. As a matter of fact, I majored in agriculture and print shop because I wanted to be the preeminent marijuana farmer in South Central. And if that didn't work, I would print my own money. And I tell you, I'll never forget it. All terrified, I called Jack. I said, Jack, in order for me to keep my job, I have to have a master's degree. I said, by the time I get a master's degree, I'll be 50 years old. My sponsor laughed. He said, oh, well, Jerome, look at it this way. If you live to be 50, you'll be 50 without a master's. I'll go on and try. And I took my little old transcripts up there to the counselor. Oh, he laughed just like that guy. And he dropped them in the trash. He said, it ain't not worth a dime. You can't transfer any of this. You have to start over from scratch. And, oh, I was devastated. But, like my sponsor, I took the first class, algebra, go at the top. Never had algebra before in my life. Didn't open the book for 5 weeks, got 3 fails. On that 4th fail, I walked out. I said, the heck with this school. Let them fire me. And I got down the hall, and the teacher left 45 other students in the classroom, came and got me. Had a student and teacher conference in the hall. He said, look at this, Mr. Scott. If you come 30 minutes early, I'll come 30 minutes early, and I'll help you pass this class. I said, well, damn, I got an algebra sponsor. That was one of the 2 C's I got in my whole college career, because from then on I was on the dean's list, the president's list, and graduated summa cum laude from junior college, university, and from graduate school. And by then, of course, my dad had died, but my mom, she made every ceremony that I made. And my little wife, who was right there with me, she was right there with me too. You know, it hadn't been all great, you know. Because I was married before in the program. Doing great. She was a streetwalker, as by self-definition. And I was a Camarillo Nuthouse rethread. And we adopted a little boy. And she told him the day we went to pick him up to apply, she said, Jerome, they ain't going to give us no kid. We the kind of people they take kids from. But my adopted son was, you know, he was born on my birthday, and I didn't care if he was lame, crippled, or Down syndrome. He was a kid from me. And my son is 21 now, and he's in the United States Navy, and he's getting ready to serve a year's tour in the Mediterranean. And I'm grateful for that experience because he taught me how to be a father. Because, see, I wasn't expecting to ever be a biological father, because I had long since passed the childbearing age and being a father. And I got married in 1991, and my wife is She's 48 now. I hope she don't mind me talking her age, but she was 46, and she said, "Jerome, I want to have your baby." And that's tough for a woman 46 to want to go through that. Yeah. Now I have another son. He's 2, Matthew. And I tell you, this program has taken me to places I never dreamed for, because it is a design for living. It'll meet you right where you're at. It doesn't mean that unfortunate, disappointment things and issues are not going to come up. They're going to be there, because I believe this program gives me the ability to face life on life's terms. Because why I have such a firm belief and a faith today is I have acquired a loving and living God that has not only solved my drinking problems, but have solved all my problems. And I was devastated when I had to give up my first home. I was devastated. My family was gone. She had came downstairs and said, "I need my space." So I asked her, I said, "You want me to go upstairs and look at TV?" She introduced me to a new term, space. Had to give up the home. I was called my sponsor. He said, "Jerome, let it go lovingly, and God will replace you with something better." And I couldn't see that because my faith was so weak. And I was full of resentment, depressed and angry. And my sponsor said, "Jerome, this is killing you. You need to let this go." And he told me how to let it go. He said, "You gotta forgive 70 times 7. And what he was saying, "Jerome, you gotta pray for those people 70 times 7. And I didn't want to pray for them, but I was it was just tearing me up. And I was slowly sinking into that anguish and depression and madness because my family was gone. But I started praying, just like he outlined it for me. He said, "Jerome, what do you want? What do you want out of this world? What do you want out of life?" And my simple thing has always been this. I don't want to be rich, famous, and good looking. I want to be happy, joyous, and free. I want to be comfortable with me and comfortable with you. And he said, "Jerome, you got to pray that they have that. But you have to pray that they have it first. And then as a byproduct, maybe your God will give it to you." And I started praying through clenched teeth, because I couldn't rest and I couldn't get away from that hurt and that pain. And I was walking up to my wife and our new home in Corona. And we had just moved in it. And that February in 96, it had snowed at 10,000 feet. I mean at 1,000 feet. And the hills behind the Cleveland National Forest was dusted with snow. And I'm walking up the street from the mailbox. And I always would pray. And I had just been praying. And I'm talking about that burden was lifted. Because God had did what my sponsor said he would do. He had put me in a place twice as better than I was before. And my life is good. I look forward to the evening of coming home and Matthew coming from daycare with his mom, and he's hollering and screaming, "Daddy, Daddy, outside, outside." And you know, people see us in the market and they do a double take. You see these two old people with this little kid. But age ain't nothing but a number. Because my life is rich. And this design for living, I tell you, because I'm getting ready to go work for the county of San Bernardino as a therapist, because I need to get my license as a marriage family therapist. And that's a major transition from being outside the door, bamming on it, asking for my diagnosis and prognosis. I'm going to be on the other side of the door. Because my clinical supervisor, who is like a sponsor, say, Jerome, you have grown here as far as you can. If you stay here, you limit yourself. And you don't want to be a limited therapist. You want to get a vast amount of experience. So I applied to San Bernardino, and they hired me, and we went by the facility where I'm going to be working at. Sits off in a field. Ain't nothing around it. And my wife said, oh, such a depressing building. I say, well, it ain't as depressing as the post office. But I'm getting ready to close. I want to thank the committee and everyone responsible for me being here, including my God. And I want to thank you for warmly greeting me. But I would be truly remiss if I didn't do this, because I do this for my wife, whether she's here or not. This is how I got this fabulous woman. And I'll tell you this story. She became the group secretary after I left, and I had wrote this in the meeting book. And she was a newcomer, and she said this has sustained and helped her stay sober more than anything. Not more than anything, but she said in those early days it really helped her. And I'm going to say that and sit down and shut up in this. Oh, how constant is your precious love. I seek protection under the comforts of your wings. For you have made this day. Let me rejoice and be glad in it. For today is the first day of my life. For the rest of my life, one day at a time. And thank you, dear God, just for this day. May you lead and may you guide me in this prosperous new life. And may I never forget, during the sunshine of my life, during the storms of my life, and after the rains of my life, there is peace with you, dear God, always and forever. And all praise to the loving, living God, to whom all praise is due. I want to thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for my sobriety, but most of all, I want to thank you for another day of sanity.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, a catalog of AA and Al-Anon tapes and CDs, or to find out about our Tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at EncoreAA.com.